Hello, welcome to another Pharmacy in Practice podcast. Very special guest with us today from the legal profession. One you may know from pharmacy circles, and one you may not. So, Tanya Francis, you're very welcome. So, Tanya is a partner and a solicitor at Hempson's Solicitors, and of course, you'll know the famous, infamous Thoran Govind. So, Thoran is a community pharmacist who is currently making the jump into the legal profession. So she's a trainee solicitor at Hempson's and works alongside Tanya. So got them both on today to talk about, to be honest, there's so much happening in pharmacy at the moment. Don't really know where to start, but I thought I would start with something that was on my mind recently, which was my conversation with Mr. Rudkin of the General Pharmaceutical Council. Might as well go to the top folks, you know. And he was kind enough to answer some of my questions, and that was very welcome, actually, very, very useful and helpful for the GPHC to open themselves up in that way, to be questioned, shall we say, in a slightly different forum that I have seen before. So one of the questions I asked him, and we could just blather on after this, but one of the questions I wanted to ask you off the back of that was around the fitness to practice process for pharmacists. So I suppose the easiest thing to do is just repeat the question that I asked Duncan, and I sort of said to him, you know, is the process fit for purpose? What do you think?
Yeah, well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because it depends on what the purpose is. And the GPHC's stated purpose is to protect patients. And I suppose that you might say that they are doing that, but whether they're doing that in the most balanced and fair way is another matter. I think anyone who's been through fitness practice proceedings will say that it is the single worst experience of their professional lives, if not their entire personal lives. It is just incredibly stressful. And even if the outcome at the end of it is a good outcome, you've still lived through weeks, if not months, if not years of hell. It really is appalling. And one of the problems is that it is so slow. It takes, and I think that's one of the points that was raised in the PSA's report on the GPHC, that it does take a very long time for cases to go through the process. And to be fair, it's a problem that most of the regulators suffer from. But of course, for the registrant, for the pharmacist who is living through that, it's the delay is horrendous.
It is.
So I think that's one of the main.
Sorry, I interrupted. I was just going to say, yeah, before the call, Thoran mentioned that feeling of, you know, I really don't think anyone should underestimate that feeling of dread, even if you're completely innocent and found to be so. As you say, Tanya, it's just awful. And why is that process so long? I know you can only speak from your perspective as someone who supports these people, but what's the crack with it? Why does it take ages, basically?
Well, we often ask ourselves that on the defence side and wonder what it is that they are doing over there, why it takes them so long. So I'm not sure I can answer. I mean, I think you know, but it does take time. It does take time to properly investigate an allegation. But you do often wonder why it has to take quite so long. And I think, you know, part of the issue is that there are cases which could be closed at an earlier stage. There are cases where more is made out of a complaint than needs to be, when it's really not that serious, and a more proportionate response with less investigation might be more appropriate. But it is difficult. It's very difficult to, it takes experience, doesn't it, to know whether a case is serious or not. And I think the problem is that when you're running a process and you've got people who are managing cases, you can't of course you can't have experienced people looking at every single case. You've got to manage teams in an efficient way. And I suppose that if you've got caseworkers following processes, then sometimes things just take longer than they should, or certainly longer than we would want them to take from the defence point of view.
Yeah, one of the areas I sort of discussed with them was around the fact that, and this is kind of easy pickings for a have a go journalist like me, you know, pharmacy practice will always be ahead of regulation. You know, that's just fact. The GPHC will never be right up to date with what's happening because professions evolve, practice changes, and technology evolves. All those factors come into play. But my assertion to him was that practice was accelerating in certain areas, particularly in the prescribing scene. I don't know whether you support a lot of people that have had complaints around prescribing activity, but my question to him off the back of that was, you know, how can you guard against unconscious incompetence? And with the greatest respect, I don't think he really answered it in a way that sort of satisfied me, to be honest. So I don't know if you've got a view on that, either of you, Thoran, as well.
I mean, I think sometimes it can be quite difficult because I think the worry about fitness to practice proceedings can actually hinder innovation within the profession, because you're constantly thinking, well, can I do this service, or is the GPHC going to be, on my tail, which I think isn't necessarily the best thing for patients either. I think what worries me particularly with regards to regulation and fitness to practice is sometimes there are pharmacists who aren't aware of what the role of the GPHC is, and it's not here to support us, unfortunately. So I think it's so important. If you take anything from this podcast, and I'm sure, you know, Tanya will have some highlights as well, is to get that support. If you get that letter, if you get anything through the post, or if, you know, the inspector comes to visit, you know, you can get some support. You can go and call, you know, your legal team. You will have indemnity insurance. It's so important to get that support early on and not just bury it, because I think it can be easy sometimes when we're drowning in flu vaccines right now or MURs to think, oh, I'll deal with that later. But it is your whole livelihood at the end of the day. It's your whole profession. And I think, I mean, I really do understand, you know, I've been there myself, where you're having a really difficult day at work and you're thinking, what's the outcome of this going to be? You know, I'm worried. And I think we all have days like that. So I just think being a bit informed and aware about the fitness to practice process is so important. I mean, when you actually look at the statistics, last year it was only 16 people who were removed from the register. But when you're in your day-to-day practice worrying about every little thing, that can feel like it's going to be, you know, going to be you. So I think it's really important to be really aware of the process, really.
Yeah.
I think that's right. Another thing that's really important is to be aware of your regulatory body's guidance to you and read it, because it's incredible how many people haven't read it and don't even know it's there. And something happens, they get into trouble. And then they say, but, you know, I didn't know that I wasn't meant to do this, or whatever it might be. And particularly where it comes to personal conduct, you know, the number of people who say to me, but this had absolutely nothing to do with my job. It was outside working hours. I wasn't at work. It's nothing to do with my job. You know, why is my regulatory body interested in this? And they are, because, you know, the regulators expect registrants to act in a manner befitting their professional status, and if you don't, then they will come after you, depending on what's happened. And a lot of people don't realize that, and there's a lot of guidance about what is and isn't acceptable in personal conduct, you know, your social media, that anything, that kind of thing. So it's worth looking at it and reading it and being aware of what is and isn't acceptable, because that will stand you in good stead and make sure you don't end up receiving one of those heart sink letters that you were mentioning, Florian. And absolutely, if you get a letter like that, take advice straight away. Don't ignore it. Don't try and do it on your own. You will need some advice from someone, whether it's a lawyer, whether it's a professional advisor. Hopefully you've got insurance an indemnity provider pick up the phone to them straight away and get some help. There's lots of people out there who want to help you and who are experienced, and it really does matter. It's not simply a question of putting forward your side of the story as quickly as possible. It's just not that simple. You really need to wait for the right moment and say the right things at the right moment. Otherwise, you will not get the best outcome for yourself.
Very good. Good sound advice. We do. I mentioned to you when we talked last that we do these professional dilemmas on pharmacy practice, and shameless plug, where we've teamed up with a university in the UK, and the dilemmas, I'm very proud to say, I mean, this is a very minor exclusive and probably no one will care except me, but but yeah, they're gonna write it into the course, and we're going to explore professional dilemmas with the students. Anyway, shameless plug aside, one of the dilemmas I did was about a pharmacist night out, and it is, you're right, Tanya, it is remarkable how I know the sample's probably insignificant and, you know, it's just a straw poll really. But anyway, the results were remarkable, because what the regulator's view is of what pharmacists should be doing in their own time versus what a lot of pharmacists think is really quite far apart. And, you know, I think one of the statistics was, so this night out was quite a wild night out. There was a fight, there was shouting. It was a works night out though, so I don't know if that made a difference. I'll maybe have to do a completely separate non-works night out one and see what the results are. But anyway, the final scene of this was basically recreational cocaine use at a party. And the final question in the dilemma was, would you report? So the person we were following casually observed the pharmacist taking cocaine, really, which of course is completely illegal. Now 21% of the respondents said they wouldn't report that to the regulator. So I don't know what your view on that is, if you have a view. I didn't reveal that statistic to you before, but is that a surprise to you, or is that?
It doesn't surprise me, because I'm sure that those who responded to your question were pharmacists who would naturally have a disinclination to shop their colleagues to their regulatory body. But if the regulatory body were to find out about it from someone else, that would be another matter. They might well be interested in it. And the issue isn't, I mean, there's several issues, aren't there? There's a conduct issue. So you don't want people in the profession to be bringing the profession into disrepute, to use the old fashioned language, by behaving badly in public. But also, mm-hmm. when it comes to drugs, the thing that the regulator worries about is there a drug problem? Has this registrant got a health problem that we need to worry about? Do we need to check that they are, that their health is good enough to practice? And that is a concern that they will have, and they will want it. So it's not the fact that it was outside of working hours might reveal that there is an issue in working hours, and that's really serious. So yeah, I'm not surprised at the answer, but I'm afraid that it doesn't reflect the reality of the risk.
No, it doesn't, does it? But yeah, you get, and we did one on social media as well, and yeah, again, fascinating. Folk are so disinhibited on there; they just forget that you are registered 24/7. You know, you don't have to be an angel, but you know you've got to remember you're a pharmacist at the end of the day.
And it's public as well. It's public, and you know, everyone can see it. So if you're having a go at someone else on there, a fellow professional, it doesn't look great for you. It doesn't look great to the regulator either. Nobody wins, really.
It's lose, 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 isn't it? Yeah. But yeah, I digress. And that was, yeah, a very convoluted way to get a shameless plug in there. So stay tuned to hear about that collaboration. I'm dead excited about it. But the question I was going to ask before I diverted into that was around faith in the system. So do you think there is faith in the fitness to practice system? And I suppose off the back of that, if not, do you think cases are not being referred because people well, for various reasons, one of which might be that it's maybe it's a case that the person who's reporting thinks needs to be referred, but they maybe err on the side of not reporting because they don't want to put the person through the process, which is possibly worse than the outcome of the fitness to practice hearing. What do you think?
Just to add, just with pharmacy in particular, not with other professions, obviously we get members of the public reporting. So I'm not sure if the issue of, you know, preferring not to report is as big as an issue. I mean, Tanya, what would you say with regard to the other professions that we would deal with and support?
Yeah, I think that's interesting. I absolutely agree with you. I mean, the question of whether there's faith in the system will very much, the answer will depend on who you're asking. So if you're asking pharmacists or other registrants about whether they have faith in their regulatory body, I'm afraid you're not going to get a very positive response. But if you're asking members of the public or employers, other healthcare providers, you might get a different answer. And I'm sure that most members of the public have no view one way or the other, but they'll simply make the referral because that's the appropriate body to whom the referral should be made. So I mean, from our point of view, from a defence lawyer's point of view, which is a pretty niche point of view, I think that the outcomes are usually fair. Not always, obviously, but then you can appeal. But I think the outcomes are usually fair. But it's getting there. That's the problem.
Okay.
Alongside the issue of the fitness to practice and all that process, sometimes there might be a claim running alongside that. So, you know, I think it really is overwhelming for healthcare professionals who are going through this process. You know, it isn't pleasant. You know, as we said earlier, you know, cases can run for years and years, and that can have an impact on family life and lots of other things. So it's not to be taken lightly when you get a letter or something like that, really.
No, definitely. And yeah, you've both preempted me with the public service broadcasting element and some really, really useful advice that basically don't ignore it as your advice and seek advice and get support. I wrote, here's something I wanted to ask you as well. I wrote an article a while ago, which I should have said to you before this podcast, but never mind, I'll send it to you after. And it was around some pharmacists should get penalty points. And it was shortly after I got penalty points on my driving license, bad boy that I am. I felt really bad about that. Of course, as a pharmacist, I was horrified. I forgot that there was an exemption for minor traffic offences, so I didn't have to declare it. But of course, when the letter dropped through the door and I was doing, I can't remember what it was. It was like 62 and a 50 or something, and mortified. But do you think that approach could ever be helpful in pharmacy regulation or fitness to practice cases?
Points. I don't see how you could, because what you're looking at in regulation is whether the pharmacist is fit to practice, currently fit to practice. So it's a bit binary. You either are or you aren't. If you are, fine. If you're not, then you may need support. You may need conditions on your registration for a while whilst you get back up to speed. Sorry, no pun intended. you might need to be removed from the register for a period of time in order for the regulator to express their disapproval of what you've done, and you will be expected in that time to go off and do something about it, whatever the problem was. So I mean, there's a system of warning and advice letters, as you know, and I suppose that's a bit like getting points. It's, you know, don't do it again, next time you'll be in more trouble. But I can't see how you translate into points, because how would you, you'd have to have a really clear idea of how serious a particular misdemeanor was, and I think that would be quite difficult.
What do you think,
I'd completely agree with that. I think It would be a bit difficult, because also I think we'd be worried about getting a letter through the post every so often as well. And I just think just like, you know, that fear when you've got that letter through the post, Jonathan, the same thing. I do think, yeah, you're either fit to practice or you're not. I don't think this can be a sort of, you're a little bit fit to practice. So, yeah, I think that would be really difficult. I'm not quite sure how the GPHC are going to move forward, because obviously they are reviewing the fitness to practice process. But I think it's tricky to see how they're going to move forward with that, but it definitely needs some sort of change. But I know they're going to be consulting with the public and obviously with registrants, but as a registrant myself, I'm not holding up much hope of how much how important my input will be. That's my personal view, but it'd be interesting to see what happens, really.
I know that's, well, a couple of things. The penalty points idea came from, a number of examples, really, of, and I know pharmacy Twitter is not reality, but there have been some fairly spectacular Twitter conversations by senior leaders in the pharmacy profession that I, if I had the power, I would certainly give them penalty points. But actually, writing the article helped get me over that, so that was fine. Yeah, one of the things you mentioned, Tanya, before we chatted, which I found quite interesting, was who makes the complaints against various professions, and you reckoned it wasn't uniform across the board. So can you differentiate between who usually complains about a doctor versus who normally complains about a pharmacist, for example?
Sure. So most complaints about doctors are made by their employer, but roughly half, or a bit over half, and a similar percentage for pharmacists is made by members of the public, which is probably not surprising given that, you know, pharmacy is a very public facing profession, but that the what we don't know is, and the regulators may know this, but I can't find that information, is whether there's a difference in what happens to complaints as they go through the system depending on who's made them. For pharmacists, I mean, I think we do have that data for doctors, and it seems that those complaints that are made by employers do tend to be the ones that go through, which perhaps isn't surprising. But for pharmacists, I don't think we have that data. So I don't know whether the complaints that are made by colleagues or employers are more likely to proceed than those that are made by members of the public. But certainly in terms of sheer numbers, most complaints are made by members of the public.
Interesting. And one area of real concern, to be honest, is the disproportionate percentage of referrals that come from the Black and ethnic minority groups. So, I mean, why do you think that happens?
Yeah, it's really hard to know, isn't it? Because certainly Black and ethnic minority pharmacists are overrepresented in terms of referrals. So a greater proportion than is the proportion on the register are referred in. But because those referrals are coming from members of the public, it's really difficult to know why that is. It's not an institutional problem, because it's individuals making those referrals. What would be more interesting to look at, because obviously the regulators can't do anything about what is being referred into them, what's more interesting is how the regulators then deal with those cases once they've received them. So I know the GPHC were planning to do a trial where they would redact the name of the registrant in the complaint and see if that made any difference to the triage process. I don't know what's happened to that plan, because it was due to take place this autumn and they may have other things on their minds now, but that would be really interesting to see what happens to those referrals as they come through, and whether there is an issue within the regulator rather than at the referral stage.
Yeah, so when a Black or ethnic minority person is referred, there is an overrepresentation. And then I suppose what you're saying is, are these people treated more harshly when they're in the system? That is the key question, isn't it, really?
Yeah. And that's the key question for the regulator, because that's something they have got control over, whereas they haven't got control over the referrals. And we do know that the composition of the tribunals doesn't reflect the composition of the profession, and that's an issue. Well, it's an issue that goes much wider than the GPHC, but it's an issue that needs to be looked at. But yeah, we don't know enough about where the problems are to be able to do anything about them. All we know is that there is a problem.
And if it's unknown unknowns, then we can't fix it, unfortunately. No. Thoran, have you any thoughts? Or
I mean, as we know, the pharmacy profession does tend to have a greater proportion of BAME individuals. But I think it is worrying, and part of this process that the GPHC are going to, where they're going to look at the fitness to practice process, has to look at how, whether there's, you know, any sort of inequalities with how people are treated. And I think, you know, and we've seen it with the exam as well. We have seen that there are issues with the exam and the registration exam and who's passing the exam and who isn't. So it seems like there are some deep-rooted issues that need to be looked at by the regulator.
Yeah, certainly needs more illumination, I think. That's quite a serious note to end on. So it was, and I don't want folk to go away on that serious note, but it's very important we all try and face into these difficult issues, I think, and not shy away from them. So yeah, listen, it's been great speaking to you. One final thing, I suppose I always ask folk, the final question is always, what's your advice for newly qualified pharmacists coming onto the register? But I suppose I would ask that question of you both through the lens of a fitness to practice, or, you know, staying out of trouble lens, if that's all right. So what's your advice to keep your nose clean as a pharmacist, as it were?
So as you know, as we've said already, don't just put it under the MUR pile and forget about it. You know, you just need to keep up to date, and if there are issues, it's better to try and sort them out earlier on. And I say that whether it's your legal, whether it's a legal issue or it's a simple matter of trying to find a prescription when a patient rings you up to say, is it there? Just try and find it right there and then, rather than waiting till they walk through the door. Documentation is so important, I think. As I have sort of gone through this process of, you know, being a trainee as well, that it's become more and more important to me to document. So even if you can't document right there, right then, even if you just have a small diary that you can make some notes in, it will come in useful one day. You know, hopefully you won't need to look at it again, but it might help you next flu season. So those are probably my two biggest things. The other thing I've sort of learnt as well is to do with consent, and some of the issues that we deal with can be to do with consent. And I think it's difficult sometimes when we are, you know, with members of the public, and we have to remember that we have to learn as healthcare professionals that, you know, things aren't black and white. We have to adapt to patients, and I think that's one of the biggest things that I've seen through learning through this legal process, is making sure that there's ongoing consent. So there's those are my three top tips for newly qualified pharmacists to keep an eye out for, definitely.
Yeah, I think those are really good tips. Keeping good records, good documentation is absolutely vital, and will be worth every minute extra that you spend keeping good records will be worth it in the long run. Communicating well with colleagues, with bosses, with patients, with members of the public, and I think and looking after yourself as well, looking after your own health, keeping a balance in your life. It's, you know, particularly now times are really difficult, and we do see a lot of professionals of all stripes who struggle with their mental health throughout their careers, and often really find it difficult to ask for help because they're the ones who are giving the help. That's their job, and it's really difficult to admit that you need help. But it's important that you should do that, and that you deserve care as much as anyone else. And people worry about the effect on their job and their career. But the that although we have perhaps been very critical of the regulators, that the health process is more sympathetic than the rest of the fitness practice process, and is designed really to check that someone is well enough to work, and if they're not, to ensure that there's conditions in place to keep them safe, them safe and their patients safe, and people will work with conditions where they have to see a healthcare professional and be supervised by whether it's a psychiatrist or some other therapist or whatever they might need depending on the health condition, and they can carry on working like that. And that is a safe way to make sure that you can get better, carry on working, and not do any harm. So I think that's another really important piece of advice.
Great advice, both. And as the unqualified legal person in the room, I'm gonna throw in my 2 pence worth as well. I always think anything to do with fitness to practice, it really helps if you're honest. Because things, if you start to if you make an honest mistake, and even if it's a fairly serious clinical mistake, if you try and dishonestly dig your way out of it, I think it just, maybe you could confirm this from a fitness to practice perspective, but my impression is that it just escalates it logarithmically into oblivion. And absolutely. Would you agree with that, Tanya?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, a clinical error is ultimately remediable. You can get over that. You can do some more training. You can learn about your mistake and make sure that you're never going to do it again. But an allegation of dishonesty is so hard to defend and so hard to come back from, because it's how do you remediate that? How do you show someone that you are not a dishonest person, you're not going to do it again? It's incredibly difficult. And that, it's one of the hardest things that we do as defence lawyers. It can be done, but it's really difficult, and it's a much, much more straightforward case to defend. If it's a simple clinical error, you put your hands up, say you're sorry, you do what you can to put things right as quickly as possible, make sure you tell everyone you need to tell, and then do something about it.
Here's another one. Right, I will shut up now. I mean, this was supposed to finish about 10 minutes ago, but that's another question, actually, that I've just thought of. Sorry. Should you, and there's a bit of debate amongst my peers over the years around this topic. So if you make a mistake, let's just say it's a dispensing error, inadvertent dispensing error, which is still a criminal offence, should you apologise to the patient?
Yes. I mean, it's never that simple, is it? But on the whole, yes. Because you have a duty to that patient, a duty of care to that patient, and it's very hard to see how you can meet that duty without apologising for a mistake that you've made. I mean, you don't need to admit a criminal offence, for example, and you don't need to admit that your fitness to practice is impaired. Those are completely different issues. But apologising for a mistake, yes, you should do that. And that will almost always help. It might not make things go away, but it will almost always help. And it's the professional thing to do.
Yeah, and it's just agree. Thorin agrees. Excellent.
Yeah,
okay.
I agree.
Right. More importantly, Thorin, when are you scheduled to qualify? Because I need a solicitor on the end of the phone.
I'll let you know. Well, you'll get the first update, Jonathan.
I'm hoping so, because you just never know. I'm always dreaming about that letter dropping through my letterbox.
You can call Tanya or me anytime.
I will.
Yeah, we're there for you, don't worry.
Perfect. Great. Listen, I've really enjoyed this. Really insightful and interesting. And I think there's hopefully we can do it again. I would love, as I said to you previously, I'd love to have you on to dissect future dilemmas once we start them up again. Be really interested to see what the legal view on those situations are and how representative you think pharmacy practice readers' opinions are. But we can touch base about that again. And listen, thanks very much, and we'll see you soon.
See you soon.
Thanks.
Thank you.